Time again for Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal, our monthly in-depth look at environmental news and issues of the region. Today, preserving open space in the time of budget cuts and getting more people connected to the land that's already been protected from development. Maryland's new governor is following his predecessor's lead in using money earmarked for program open space to cover budget deficits. For the next few years, that means the program again will have only a fraction of the money intended to create parks and preserve farmland. We'll hear more about that from Rona and meet Joel Dunn. He's executive director of the Chesapeake Conservancy, which defends and promotes the Bay as a national treasure. Midday on the Bay, after the news from NPR. And welcome to the second hour of our show. Dan Roderick's here. It's midday, and this hour, Midday on the Bay, our monthly in-depth look at environmental news with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. We do this show in collaboration with the Bay Journal. Rona, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
A big feature of the day today is open space, preserving open space in the time of budget cuts in particular. We're going to be talking about that during this hour of the show, and we have a special guest visiting with us, Joel Dunn, executive director of the Chesapeake Conservancy. To let our listeners know what's going on in Annapolis with regard to program open space and the preservation of land in Maryland and money that might be available for that, that should be available for that, that may not be. So we'll be dealing with that in this hour of the show. But first, Rona's had a couple of interesting stories in the Bay Journal that I thought was worth talking about here in the early going, just some, a little bit of Chesapeake-related news. One has to do with an old dam. Why don't we start with that story, because I love to say the name of this dam, Bloedy Dam, B-L-O-E-D-E, right?
That's correct.
It's one of the dams on the Patapsco River.
Right, that's right. So there's four dams on the Patapsco River that NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service... National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I know we're an acronym-free zone here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, once in a while you say something and it's like, NOAA sounds like a guy's name.
Right.
So I figure, you know, just do it once and then we're done.
Okay, so a bunch of federal agencies and the state and American Rivers, which is a nonprofit, have made a commitment to take these four dams away from the Patapsco River and get rid of them. There are several reasons. One, migrating fish, river herring, eels, and Dan's favorite hitchhiker, the eastern elliptical mussel or ellipteal mussel
freshwater mussel.
It hitches a ride on the eel, and their populations are decimated. So the idea is get rid of these dams so the fish can run free. And if you get rid of them, then you have 50 miles of river from the Patapsco to the Chesapeake Bay. It can basically go from Ellicott City to the Bay Bridge unobstructed.
And they've taken down one dam already or two?
The federal government has spent $4.5 million to take down two dams. Bloedy is the third. And then there's one more smaller one. The Bloedy Dam project is going to cost $8 million. All of that's going to come from the feds, but they needed a $1 million commitment from the state of Maryland. And in the $115 million cut to open space, Bloedy Dam was a casualty of that cut. That $1 million was also cut.
This is in the proposed budget of the new governor, Larry Hogan.
Right. This is in the proposed budget of the new governor. And I thought, well, you know, they're cut $115 million. Maybe they didn't notice the $1 million. So I called their attention to it, and we had a back-and-forth go-round where they said, of course, we're still going to get the federal money without the state match. And I said, no, you aren't. And it came back to, we're committed to restoring the funds to get rid of Bloedy Dam. And one of the reasons that
I didn't hear this part. I knew about your story. Your original story said, If the state doesn't put $1 million in, it doesn't get the match from the feds. I didn't know that you had influenced some decision. Is this true? Has this happened?
One hopes that the Bay Journal had some influence on this decision, but I think it was in part the federal partners alerting the state to the fact that if they didn't put the money back, this project was in jeopardy, which they had done. But I think our article just amplified that. So they have made a verbal commitment that they are going to put the money back in, but the money is still not back. So we'll have to kind of see how it plays out.
Let's just go over for a moment, Rona, the importance of taking down these dams. Why we bother do this? And you mentioned this quickly, but I think it's worth talking about. We'll get to the mussel in a minute, the freshwater mussel.
Well,
but,
the,
you know, this is not the way the river was originally. Let's start with that. It's not, you're restoring an attempt to restore the river to its historic best, right?
Right. And the Blody Dam has not, it was created by Mr. Blody to generate power for a mill, and it has not performed that function since 1932. So you have a couple things going on. You have the migrating fish coming down the Patapsco and literally hitting a concrete wall. They cannot go to spawn. Then you have the fact...
Going up the Patapsco.
Right, going up the Patapsco.
Sorry.
Then you have the sediment. It traps the sediment, and in a way, trapping sediment is good, but it can also be a bad thing because some of that is good sandy bottom that the fish need. It creates habitat problems, it creates water flow problems, and it in general does change a river from its natural state, which is one of the reasons American Rivers has been so involved. And in places like Cleveland, getting rid of dams has actually improved the water quality and cleaned up the river. The Cuyahoga River, for example, is in much better shape today, in part because some of these dams have been taken away. So, and with Blody Dam, this is a very sad situation. And you can look online and Google Images and see people like to slide down the Blody Dam. It looks like it's a lot of fun if you're a thrill seeker type of person. You get on the dam and you slide on down. And but several years in a row, people have died doing this. Five people have died in the Blody Dam since in the last 20 years. And because it's located in Patapsco State Park on a nice day, it seems like a great idea, even though signs are posted all over the place not to do it. People do it. So it's not only to protect the fish, but it's also a public protection. And the dam is badly out of shape. It needs safety upgrades, and the state would spend $1 million to keep it in place anyway. So they might as well remove it and not have to deal with it anymore.
On the story of the mussel, I just like to repeat it because it's an interesting story from nature. This is a freshwater mussel that used to be plentiful in the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries that helped filter the water, much like the oysters. And the Anguilla rostrata, the American eel, in its migratory pattern along the way, would pick up larvae of this freshwater mussel and carry it upstream and where it would thrive and grow for many years. But once dams went up, and this was true of Deer Creek that flows down to the Susquehanna, the eel couldn't make passage, and
right.
Neither could its passenger on board, the freshwater
right.
mussel. So now they think there'll be more opportunity for the mussels to be further up the Patapsco River and help filter it.
Absolutely,
so I thought
yes.
I'd throw that in there. The other story, so we think the state's going to match the bottom line on this story?
I think so.
Okay.
I've heard from several sources within the state that there have been commitments made. So, of course, the Bay Journal will continue to follow the story.
Be interesting when the dam does come down. That'd be the last dam, the last of the Patapsco dams.
There's one more.
There's one more.
It's called the Daniels Dam. But
that's right. The one up at Daniels.
The Blody project is a little more complicated because it requires the movement of a sewer line, and that's why it costs $8 million. The Daniels project will be much less expensive.
It'll be interesting to see just what this does to the quality of the water in the Patapsco over time. Okay, and the other story you had has to do with oyster farming in the Chesapeake Bay. You point out in this story, Rona, and I think this is true, I guess, every year that you've been covering the legislature and environmental-related legislation in Annapolis. Every year, watermen have asked the General Assembly to introduce bills to allow them to catch more fish, oysters, and crabs than currently they're limited to. And
this is
something like this going on this year as well with oysters in particular.
Right. Well, there are two bills. One bill is a bill to open power dredging in the Chesapeake Bay, to open the oyster beds to power dredging.
To power dredging.
Power dredging is a form of taking oysters out of the bottom where you use a dredge scrape. So you scrape along the bottom and you take out the oysters. There are many areas in the Chesapeake Bay where you are not allowed to power dredge, and you have to collect oysters the old way using hand tongs or nippers. And the idea behind that is that you're trying to preserve the oyster reefs. You want the oysters to hang together. And so if you drag a dredge on the beds, then you're breaking up the oysters. And watermen say that it's good to break up the oysters because you break up the sediment and you get them clean. But scientists say that it's good to have them in a reef. So Power dredging is allowed in the Tangier Sound and in a couple other places, but it hasn't been allowed north of the Bay Bridge. And the reason why is because the oysters are not reproducing that well up there because the water's fresher. And so the fear is that if you allow power dredging, you will take out all the oysters and the oysters will not replenish themselves. So most places, oysters have a spat set, which means they reproduce every 2, 3, 4 years. In the Upper Bay, it's more like every 10 years. So if you take them out, the fear is that you won't get them back. So that's a bill to try to get something that isn't currently allowed.
Okay. And they want that to increase the harvest or just do it quicker? Or what's the idea?
Yeah, both.
Okay.
There was a really good oyster year last year, 420,000 bushels of oysters. It was one of the best years we've had in a really long time.
Is that just Maryland or Virginia?
That was just Maryland.
Wow.
And the Maryland had the second best oyster harvest in the country. We were second only to Texas. So we really, I mean, in part, it's because so many other places are struggling. Louisiana's struggling and the Pacific Northwest are struggling. But the Bay had a couple good spat sets and some good management went on, and we were able to get that. And so I think the watermen see an opportunity now that if we're allowed to use this dredge, that they can get a larger harvest. So, but there's a lot of controversy about it because of what it does to the beds.
Yeah, and the oyster comeback is still in its early stages.
Very early stages.
Oyster sanctuaries now that were put in place by the O'Malley administration.
More
of those, and there's more oyster farming going on. Maryland is finally catching up to Virginia, I think, when it comes to oyster farming.
Right, and that's where the second bill comes in. This is a bill that watermen have requested, the Maryland Watermen's Association requested, and it's the words are to mitigate and minimize the damage, the conflicts from what they call cage culture and watermen. So the part of oyster aquaculture that's growing really quickly is what we call cage culture. It's oyster farmers raising single oysters, which they sell for about 50 cents, and then restaurants sell them to us for about, you know, $2, you know, really pretty nice oysters. And this is where you put a lot of investment in, but you can also really make some money. And this conflicts with things like trot lining for crabs or doing hydraulic dredging for razor clams, because those are some of the same areas. So what the watermen have asked for is a bill that basically gives them consideration in this process. Now, they already have consideration because the Department of Natural Resources takes about 6 months to issue an aquaculture lease, and they look at all kinds of things and they give public notice, but they want more consideration.
Meaning they want more area to grow oysters in. Is that what they mean?
No, they want the people who trot line and who catch razor clams want to sort of minimize the cage guys. They want the cage guys.
Oh, okay, the other way. Okay.
Yeah,
these aren't the oyster farmers looking to expand.
Right.
These are the other watermen who do other things.
Because the thing is, the oyster farmers, some watermen have gotten into aquaculture, but most watermen have not gotten into the cage culture. They're doing spat-on-shell oyster raising on the bottom.
That's the old-fashioned way.
The old-fashioned way, right. So they are not real keen on having these non-watermen oyster farmers who were raising oysters in cages taking over what they perceive to be their traditional areas where they would crab and clam. So we're having what I refer to as a bit of a new oyster war between these new players that are coming in and trying to both improve water quality and improve their bottom line, and the old way of doing it, which was more of an extraction, you might say.
Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal joining us for another edition of Midday on the Bay. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about program Open Space, preserving land in Maryland in the Chesapeake region and the importance of that. We'll be speaking with Joel Dunn, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Conservancy in Annapolis, that organization dedicated to preserving land and also getting more people in touch with the land that we treasure around the Chesapeake. So we'll do that after this short break. Midday on the Bay here on WYPR. Mm-hmm. And welcome back to Midday. Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Maryland's new governor is following his predecessor's lead in using money earmarked for program open space to cover budget deficits. And for the next few years, analysts in Annapolis say that that means that the program, again, will have only a fraction of the money intended to create public parks and preserve farmland. We're talking about that in this hour of our show, in this segment of Midday on the Bay with Rona. And now we're joined by Joel Dunn, who's executive director of the Chesapeake Conservancy, which defends and promotes the Bay as a national treasure. Did I get that right, Joel? Is that what you guys do?
You did, and thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. I think, you know, program open space gets kicked around a lot. I remember in 1985, after the savings and loan crisis, that was the first time that I remember that the General Assembly, probably not the first time, but the first time that I remember the General Assembly emptying it out to use the money for other purposes. This money is funded through the transfer taxes that take place when in real estate deals in Maryland. It's been in place for years, but
it's a brilliant program.
Yeah.
It was passed as a law in 1969, and the idea was every time someone buys a house, a small percentage of a tax, a half a percent of tax, would go to a fund that was used to purchase open space to create parks, wildlife areas, ballparks near their homes. And so there would be opportunities for recreation, wildlife enjoyment, ecosystem service protection. And for years, it's been consistently rated by various administrations or to the tune of about $1 billion.
And over all that time.
Yeah. And,
wow.
I just bought a house. And so in Anne Arundel County, and I was taxed, and that tax was supposed to go to buy a park near my house.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm being told is essentially that money is going to be used for completely different purposes. And my child's not going to have a park 10 years from now because of it.
Yeah.
So
this is what gets people riled up. You know, they get riled up about the transportation fund,
right,
in Maryland. You know, that part of the tax from the gas, for the gasoline we buy, goes to that to keep the roads repaired. But here's another one. It does get kicked around a lot. I wonder how people feel about this. I'll throw out the phone number here as we talk about program open space with Joel Dunn and Rona Cabell. 410-662-8780. I just want to mention, Joel, the numbers that I have most recently that we got from the Department of Natural Resources. Program Open Space, as you say, established in the 1960s to acquire land for public use, parks, forests, wildlife habitat, just natural and scenic areas. 370,231 acres by now. Does that sound about right to you?
That's right. And yeah. I mean, some of those parks like Quiet Waters Park in Annapolis or Sandy Point State Park are great economic drivers for our local communities. They're great places to get in touch with the Chesapeake Bay so that we raise a future generation that cares about the Bay, that votes for it, that donates to it, that commits their careers to it.
Do you say to people who say, Dan, I just heard you mention 370,000 acres. That sounds like a lot to me. How much is enough? What do you say to people when they say that?
Well, I mean, actually, I've seen some statistics on how much open space communities need for a livable community, and those figures vary. But, I think if we're to protect this ecosystem, the Chesapeake Bay we know and love, we need to do that on a large scale. Those ecosystems are operating, or ours in particular, from Cooperstown to Virginia Beach. You know, postage stamp parks are important, but to just simply protect a small park is not enough. We need to link up multiple parks. We need to make sure that wildlife can migrate, that ecosystems can adapt to sea level rise and climate change, that every community has access to a park. It's pretty remarkable. The Chesapeake Bay has 11,000 miles of shoreline, but less than 2% of that is publicly accessible. So if you're not really wealthy and own waterfront, you're never really going to know the value, the beauty of the Chesapeake Bay, unless you have a public park nearby that you can access to get on your kayak or even just walk along the shoreline. Those are really valuable resources. They're valuable economically. They're valuable for our physical health, but also our spiritual health.
Rona, on program open space, I know that you're an advocate of just, you said you call them postage stamp parks, but some of these in more urban or near urban or suburban settings are very important, and there's still opportunities there.
Yeah, I think last time on the show we mentioned Pierce's Park downtown on the.
Oh, that's
right
on the harbor. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's a small place, and its primary function is really to retain stormwater. And they've got all these porous pavement structures and all that. But it's become a destination in itself. It's a low impact play area, and I actually think Baltimore City and Chicago and other cities have really. Chicago got it a long time ago, but I think Baltimore City is getting it, and Philadelphia and D.C. and cities are understanding that green space has a lot of benefits. Counties seem to not be getting it. And to me, that's ironic because people move from the city to the county for more green space. And I think what they get is more sprawl.
All right. Let's talk about the numbers here a little bit this year. According to The Sun, my colleague at The Sun, Michael Dresser, is reporting Governor Hogan's diversion from program open space is about $38 million. Is that about $38 million, he says, in transfer tax revenue intended for land preservation? Now, that could be more than just program open space, but because there's other programs for land preservation as well.
Yes, but they're all derived from the transfer tax revenues.
That all comes from the same source.
So whether you're talking about the Rural Legacy Program, the Maryland Land Preservation Program, The total is actually more to the tune of $115 million when you consider the $38 million recommended by the Hogan administration, the $77 million planned by the O'Malley administration.
I was going to say, O'Malley dipped into program open space several times during his administration.
That's correct. For the most part, he replaced those diversions with bond funding, either in the year that he took them or moved it to prior year promises or future year promises.
Explain that, would you, for our listeners? Yeah. So if he replaced cash, right,
yes,
with bond funding, meaning we'll use a bond to acquire some land for a park? Is that what
he... That's right. So the most valuable thing for the budget is cash. And so Program Open Space accumulates cash every year. So what a prior administration did was to take that cash to use it for other purposes, but yet get approval from the legislature to replace that cash with bonding authority so they can borrow money to buy land if they find land they want to buy up to a certain amount.
So what do you think of that idea?
It's less ideal than having cash on hand, but it's also it's nice to have some funds available to purchase tremendous land conservation opportunities. I'll give you an example. Back about 6 years ago, the Jesuits decided they wanted to sell three peninsulas down on the Potomac River. This was 5,000 acres of some of the most pristine shoreline in the Chesapeake Bay, some of the most historic areas. John Smith explored that back in 1608. The shoreline looked just like it did back then. And so Program Open Space used money to purchase those lands for historic preservation, for public benefit. They're creating a state park out of it, a state forest. It was just a tremendous opportunity. They had the funds on hand to purchase that land. If you had cash or bonds, either way, you could still have done that. The problem with the current budget proposal is that there's not a replacement of those funds necessarily with bonds in the future.
Oh, there isn't. Okay. So that was something the O'Malley administration did, but it's not in the Hogan plan.
They are using some bonding authority to pay for land acquisition, but it's much less than is being withdrawn.
So they're proposing cutting this approved bond funding from the previous year.
They're proposing eliminating it. Yeah. So
they don't want any more deficits, right?
That's right. Yeah. And in addition to that, there was
They don't want any more debt.
There was $12 million in cash that the program had on hand in the Board of Public Works back in December. This was prior to the Hogan administration taking office, which was recommended to be withdrawn from the program and sent to the general fund. And that's on top of a 20% reduction in transfer tax revenues just due to the slowing real estate market. So I don't want to point the finger at any one administration or any one legislator. It's more of a systematic problem here we have in terms of our public commitment to land conservation.
Yeah, I see it. I mean, you have a program that's in place for a specific reason, funded a specific way. they devised this 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, and they pick at it. They more than pick at it. They actually empty it out.
It happens on the federal level, too. The Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund, which was set up using offshore oil drilling revenues to the authorized level of $900 million, they typically, you only fund that at $350 million for the entire country. So it's happening on the state level. It's happening on the federal level. And that, you know, this all comes back to the need for public support for land conservation.
Yeah.
People get in contact with their legislators to say, we feel this is important. But also the private philanthropic community has a role to play here in terms of filling the gap. And we have been very fortunate at the Chesapeake Conservancy to have tremendous supporters. We've been able to line up a lot of private funding for land conservation in the absence of state and federal funding. But it really takes every single pot of money these days to protect land. It's very expensive.
410-662-8780. This is Midday on the Bay. We're speaking with Joel Dunn, who's executive director of the Chesapeake Conservancy. And with us in the studio, as always from Midday on the Bay, is Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. I just want to go over one more thing. We'll start taking some calls here so that our listeners understand one thing. The Maryland Department of Natural Resources makes an estimate on loss of agricultural and forest land to development each year. Their estimates 3 or 4 years ago was like 25,000 acres per year. By my calculations, when I look at a Maryland Department of Planning estimate based on development, and this is in 2010, so this is 5 years ago now. Back then, they were talking about a loss of 28,000 acres per year, more than DNR's estimate, and that was still coming out of the recession. So there is a loss of land to development in Maryland that continues. Now, the programs that we have, Rural Legacy Program, the Maryland Agricultural Land Preservation Program, Program Open Space, the Maryland Environmental Trust. Those are all pieces of this, our effort to preserve open land, right, Joel?
That's right.
Does all that money come from those programs? All comes from the transfer tax.
All is derived from the transfer tax. That's correct.
So you and other environmentalists probably think we're not going to be able to do much in terms of land preservation in the next...
I never think that way. I always try and think positively. I think we can do big things. In fact, the president's budget, which was released 2 weeks ago, has a line item provision for the Rivers of the Chesapeake, which is a collaborative initiative with all the four of the Bay states, was supported by 9 senators, including our Maryland senators, Barbara Mikulski and Ben Cardin, $33 million. It's on the cover of the Bay Journal's website today, the big article about the president's support for land conservation.
Rona, so this is a Chesapeake Bay Journal scoop.
Yes.
That we get to tell people about here on Midday.
Yes.
Okay, that's what Joel was just talking about.
Yes.
Actually, Joel, let me read it here. It says nearly $38 million could flow into the Bay watershed land protection efforts, mostly along Chesapeake Rivers, as you said, under this proposal in the budget from President Obama. If approved by Congress, I guess that's a big if these days, isn't it? It would be the largest federal investment to protect the region's open spaces and historic sites in recent history. Most of the funding, $33.3 million, that's what Joel was just referencing, would support a new Rivers of the Chesapeake initiative that targets the protection of large-scale landscapes along rivers, along bay tributaries.
Yeah, and that program, that partnership was inspired originally by the Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail.
Okay, stop right here. Okay. This is I was going to ask you about this today. Yeah. Another thing for our listeners to understand, the Chesapeake Conservancy sort of evolved out of this establishment of the National Historic Water Trail, right? The name for Captain Jay Smith, who came up the river and said, hey, this is a cool place. James Michener, please write a book about
this.
That's
right. It's a great story. So coming out of graduate school, Will Baker from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Pat Noonan from the Conservation Fund, and Gil Grosvenor from National Geographic had an idea. They wanted to create a national trail that celebrated John Smith's routes of exploration to create a framework for people's view of the Chesapeake Bay. What did the bay look like 400 years ago, and what does it look like today? How has it changed? What do we need to do to restore it to the way we want it to be? To give people a way to recreate, to get out on the bay, explore it, improve public access. And so that trail, sort of like the Appalachian Trail on water, if you think of it that way, goes all the way from Cooperstown to Virginia Beach, traces the rivers of the Chesapeake Bay, gives people this skeletal framework for a landscape-scale conservation initiative that brings together each conservation group, whether it's the Potomac Conservancy, the James River Association, the Midshore Riverkeeper, whoever it is, we're all working collaboratively along the rivers and the bay.
So this money goes to buy land along those along the water trail.
That's right. So the Land and Water Conservation Fund monies go to federal land management agencies. So the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management, and Forest Service will receive allocations, if Congress funds this, to purchase land in particular places around the bay.
Who identifies the possible places to purchase?
The agencies themselves, states, all the states involved, nonprofit organizations, Indian tribes. We all work together to identify the priority locations. And the concept is that these places are near other protected lands, mm-hmm. and so they link up state parks with federal parks, with private nature reserves, so that you have areas for wildlife to migrate, areas for sea level to rise and plants and animals to adapt, places to buffer communities from storm events. You know, that's kind of the concept.
I'm going to ask our listeners this. Do you feel strong enough about preserving open space and program open space to actually look up the name of your delegate or senator in Annapolis to say something about this, stop raiding this fund? Have you ever done this? I'm sure someone out in the audience has done this and cares about it, but does that matter to you, the preservation of open space? And this thing, I mean, this sounds like you have to write to you'd have to write to John Boehner or somebody to say, hey, we want this $33 million here, because there's a big if it's passed by Congress.
But I'd argue
you stay positive. Right?
We have stay positive, and we have a tremendous congressional delegation. I mean, if you think about Senator Mikulski, yeah. Senator Cardin, they're great leaders in the Congress, and they've been very supportive of this.
410-662-8780. In all, according to environmental advocates in Annapolis, the Hogan budget has reduced funding for land preservation by more than $115 million next year when you total it all up, as Joel Dunn did. Joel Dunn is executive director of the Chesapeake Conservancy. Rona Cabell is here from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, which has this scoop about the Rivers of the Chesapeake Initiative, $33 million. That's pretty cool. We'll take some calls, 410-662-8780, and you can send in a comment by email to midday@wypr.org. I already have an email here from a fan of the Bloaty Dam. I'll read that when we get back. Well, Roger says, Rhoda, I called you Rhoda twice today. I'm sorry.
I know. What's with that?
I loved Rhoda. Remember Rhoda on TV? Rona Cabell, I like the Bloaty Dam. It is a nice hike. Why not turn it back into a hydroelectric power plant and make some money?
We're getting away from that sort of thing, I think.
I don't know. Hydroelectric?
I mean,
it's alternative energy, isn't it? What?
Somewhat alternative. I mean, I think when we talk about alternative energy, what we're trying to talk about is wind, solar, and geothermal. Mm-hmm. Dams have a lot of issues. I mean, a lot of issues for fish and wildlife and habitat and sediment. And the prevailing wisdom seems to be when they are not functioning for 100 years, it is time for them to go.
Yeah. When I wrote about the earlier dams that were torn down, the two earlier ones got fan mail. On those dams, too. People didn't want to see them go because they were used to it from childhood, from seeing it. Yeah. Listen, one point about program open space. So we think about big tracts of land along a river maybe now or wherever it is, farmland out in western Maryland or in Frederick County, wherever. But also that money goes to put up baseball fields, right? Little league fields,
sure.
Tot lots, all kinds of things like that too.
Right. So it's recreational side open space. Open space is split. Half goes to recreational and half goes to what you'd call land conservation, the big tracks. So the counties can use their open space money to do things like put up a baseball diamond or put up bleachers or even maybe a concession stand. And it seems incongruous because that's not open space, but that's perfectly legal, and that's what they use the money for.
Let's take a couple of calls here. Rona Cabell from the Bay Journal and Joel Dunn, executive director of the Chesapeake Conservancy. Steve in Carroll County, we'll take your call first. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going, Dan? Great show.
Thanks,
Steve. I just wanted to take this question off the air. I'm kind of not a fan of the new governor. He kind of didn't really run on anything, and I'm kind of worried about Maryland's environment. He's anti-EPA, doesn't believe in man-made climate change, is against the rain tax, and wants to open up fracking in Western Maryland. What does Maryland's future look like with this governor, as opposed, you know, when it comes to the environment?
All right, I'm going to go to Rona on that, but, you know, I'm not sure. Did I hear Larry Hogan say that he didn't believe in climate change? I don't think so.
Earlier in the campaign, he said something that was questioning it a bit.
Okay. But as far as fracking goes, he says it's time to make a decision one way or the other, and then we had the recommendations that came out of the O'Malley Commission on fracking.
I'm hardly Larry Hogan's campaign manager here, but I'd like to maybe clarify a few of those things. He came into office, and I think some of these issues are really complex, and they've been sort of boiled down to a soundbite. And with the so-called rain tax, which I call the stormwater fee, I think it was just a matter of the fact that we need to do something about stormwater, and whatever Larry Hogan does not change the fact that we need to do something about stormwater. But in his perspective, that fee was not applied unilaterally. So I have to pay it, but my friend in Hagerstown does not have to pay it, and we could have the exact same house. So I think he was trying to say, you know, hey, this is moving a little fast, and I'm governor now, and let's see if there's a different way we can do this. And to be somewhat charitable, I think it's the same with the phosphorus. He walked in on this big deal that was going to change Maryland agriculture forever, and I think he just said, you know, we need to put on the brakes. So I'm not going to say he's...
Oh, I'm going to challenge you on that one. He didn't say it that way. He told a group of farmers that he was opposed to it, that it would devastate their business. He already made up his mind before he was even sworn in.
Well, he said it was going to be his first fight.
Yeah, no, he said it would devastate business in Maryland if we went forward with the new phosphorus rules.
Yes, but...
So you're being a little more charitable than I would be on that
but,
one.
Yeah, but I'll say, like the stormwater management fee, Maryland has to find a way to control its phosphorus. There's too much phosphorus. The Republicans who are now in office acknowledge that there's too much phosphorus, and if they don't want to use this phosphorus management tool, they're going to have to come up with some other way. So while I think that the phosphorus is a bigger deal than the stormwater management fee, I still think this doesn't – what he did was pull the regulations, and he has not said yet what he's going to do next.
Okay.
So
as far as the rain tax one goes, that just plays really well out there with his base, anti-rain tax. I mean, you can't go wrong with that. When you're opposed to a tax, it sounds like the populist view, right?
Yes.
I'm being less charitable than you in your analysis of it.
Unfortunately, it was never a tax, and it was never about the rain.
That's right.
And there's 1,432 other places in this country that have such a thing. So what I would say is, if he has a better idea, let's hear his better idea, because we have to reduce the pollution coming into the Chesapeake from stormwater and from agriculture. There's no choice in the matter. And these discussions are over the tools to get the job done, not whether or not the job is going to get done. It has to get done.
We mentioned program Open Space earlier. That's the main focus here as far as what's going on in Annapolis with that. We mentioned the cut that's been proposed by Governor Hogan and using this transfer tax money, this pot of money for program Open Space for other reasons. And so land preservation is going to be stay on a kind of a diet for the next few years under this proposal, unless this changes.
Right. And I want to just mention that requires approval from the legislature.
Right.
I mean, so this is a dedicated fund. So in 1969, when this bill was established, that money was set to go into a pool for land conservation. It requires an act of the legislature to essentially override that law and reallocate those funds to other purposes.
But they've done it in the past.
They do it repeatedly, and they use this Budget, Finance, and Reconciliation Act tool at the very end of the legislative session to do that. Now our appropriations chairs of those Senate and House committees, they have the power to influence those allocations. And there was a new chair of the Appropriations Committee from Baltimore, Maggie McIntosh, very sympathetic to open space and conservation and environment. Our hope is that she and other leaders in the legislature can alter this this situation and restore some of those funds to for open space protection.
Let me just add one other thing before we go back to the phone lines. In 2002, the General Assembly of Maryland passed a joint resolution, just a resolution, but a resolution nonetheless, calling for dramatically increasing the amount of agricultural land in preservation in the state. The goal they set was 1.03 million acres by 2022. And according to my reporting from last year or the year before, the state was about halfway to that goal. So that's only 7 years from now. So anyway, that's just another thing from the General Assembly to throw at them, when just to remind them about that.
Well, you've probably seen, if you've gone over to the Eastern Shore lately, you've probably seen these neighborhoods popping up on places that used to be farms, very productive farms.
Paula in Chestertown, calling from the Eastern Shore. Go right ahead with your question, Paula.
Yes, Dan. I'd like to make an observation because I think I may be standing on the proverbial third rail, but I am a small property owner in the rural area in Chestertown, surrounded by farmland. I have made an effort over the last 20 years to turn my property into productive habitat. I raise bees. I have fruit trees. And the farmers who have the land that surrounds me have turned the landscape into a proverbial moonscape. One of them has just taken down a hedgerow that supported milkweed and cherry and travel lanes for habitat for the creatures, insects, and birds in my area. And I look out today on the landscape surrounding Chestertown, and it's all flat fields with plants that don't support pollinators, don't provide any access for animals to go to and fro, don't provide any feed for birds. And I'm all for land conservation. I practice it actively myself, but I think the farmers need to be held to task for supporting food networks, food webs, and making their contribution to supporting habitat and the and a healthy ecosystem, rather than being so worried about scratching up their combines that they have to take down every plant and tree in sight.
So, Paula, when it comes to preserving agricultural land and the state investing in that to actually buy easements from farmers, right, say, please don't develop this land, keep it in ag, you're saying, yeah, that's good, but the downside is it remains in soybeans and corn, or right? Is that what
exactly.
You're saying?
Exactly. Monocultures, yeah. That don't support healthy habitat, well, or you healthy know, ecosystem.
I got to deal with one problem at a time here, but anyway.
Well, you know,
what do you do about that?
This is a really good point.
I just wonder, what do you do?
The Maryland Agricultural Land Preservation Foundation, they're the ones that make the decisions on what to preserve. And I actually don't know what their criteria are. It's a really good point and something to look into, whether or not just a regular old flat field qualifies, or whether putting something in that program requires buffers and milkweed. Maybe Joel knows the answer. I'm not sure, but she is absolutely right, yeah, that the continuation of these monocultures is extremely devastating.
Well, the beauty of a conservation easement is you can structure it to include some specifics about habitat maintenance and certain places on a piece of property that you want to maintain ecological integrity.
You have to get a farmer to agree to
that's it. Right. Yeah. That's right. I do know several farmers that are very progressive in terms of creating habitat on their farms, and they're very mindful of the need for pollinator habitat. I think the caller raises a really important point, though, and this just came out in like the Washington Post, I think, last week. The monarch butterflies have seen a 970 million...
Billion? No, was it million?
970 million deaths or something like that. There's only 4% of the monarch population left,
yes,
in North America. And part of that is the result of the use of monocultures and lack of habitat along the migratory pathways of the monarchs. And I can't imagine if my child was raised in this world having never seen a monarch. You know, it just, it adds to you, fuels your imagination, Right. And it's, you know, it's just a part of, it's such an important part of life. So I think she raises an important point. Alternatively, with an easement on a property, even if there are no additional restrictions, that property is not going to become a parking lot, and land can recover from being farmed, but it probably will never recover from being a parking lot.
You're right. It's closer to a billion monarchs. Let's take another call on this. Chris Delaporte is calling. Chris Delaporte used to be director of Parks and Recreation here in Baltimore City. Chris, thanks for calling.
Hey, Dan. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What did you want to add to this, Chris?
Well, I want to add to this a couple of pieces of information, but let me qualify myself for the listeners. I administered the Land and Water Fund when I was State Parks Director in Oklahoma, and then later as the administrator throughout the Carter years. And I'm very familiar with the history of that fund as well as the open space program. And here's my a factual point. Baltimore City is the only jurisdiction in the state where the open space money is allowed to be used for maintenance. It can be used, frankly, for anything. Now, one of the things that the program probably deserves is a self-examination. And that would be something like this. We should be careful about putting open space money into a system that is failing, and a government that reduces its own appropriation equal often to the amount of money that the state puts in. So
okay.
There's a...
I'm not sure, Chris, I'm not sure I'm following you. You're saying the city doesn't use the money appropriately?
No, it does use it. It does use it, but it uses it instead of general funds, so there is no net increase to the department.
Net increase in terms of funds for purchases of land.
That's right. $46 million of open space money came into Baltimore City from 2002 to 2009. That's an awful lot of money. And as Dan knows and others who live in Baltimore City, our system is declining. So a question is for the people in Annapolis, how do you fashion a policy for Baltimore that invests in a system that is increasing or improving? There are only 71 maintenance people with boots on the ground in the entire city parks department.
Okay, Chris.
So just to add to this, I recall this happening with the stormwater fee as well in Baltimore, that Baltimore had, I think, $9 million dedicated to stormwater. And when the stormwater management fee, a.k.a. rain tax, came down, the administration said, well, great, well, we'll take that $9 million that we've been spending and reduce property taxes.
Yeah.
And then we'll use new money for this.
Right.
And no, the idea was you're not doing enough and you're supposed to do more. And what I would say is it sounds like, I've not verified what Chris is saying, but it sounds like that this is just what we were saying before, too tempting, that the money's there and we have needs and so we'll spend it.
Isn't quality of life for all ultimately more important than money or the budget, writes David in Towson. Our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will likely not care at all about the budget challenges our state faces right now. They will care about the quality of life and landscapes they have to live with. I have lived in Baltimore all my life, and 56 years, and have seen every privately owned farm or woodland I know developed into houses or strip malls. I grew up inside the Beltway next to a farm which long ago became houses. Will we leave a legacy of at least some farms and open space in our state, or just another unbroken string of McMansions and strip malls? Thank you very much. We're out of time. Rona Cabell, thank you for being here today again.
Thank you.
Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and Joel Dunn, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Conservancy. And it is about a billion monarch butterflies, according to that story in the Washington Post.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thank you,
I wanted to mention we're launching a peregrine falcon camera in Baltimore City next week.
Oh, so are you?
Check it out on our website.
You did something with ospreys before,
right? This one's a peregrine cam on the Transamerica building, the 33rd floor.
Will you let us
It'll
know?
Be real cool.
Let us know when that goes up, and
yeah,
we'll post it.
Our friends at Skyline helped us set us up.
Thank you, Joel.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to our midday for today. See you again tomorrow, folks.